I'm sure you know already that it has the deepest hidden secrets. Purim is a time when the whole idea of Purim is that the secrets of the world are hidden, those secrets, and Purim's the time that you can act to bring them out. That means the secrets of your own existence. Superficially it means the secrets of Jewish history, the secrets of the creation of the world, the secret of your own purpose in life, and what your own hidden powers are. The word Megillah, in the Hasidic writings, it says that the word Megillah means a scroll, you know, the scroll of Purim, the story of Purim. But the same root in Hebrew means Megale, which means to reveal. Remarkable thing. That means as the scroll is wound, so it reveals the hidden depths. Which is a remarkable idea, because the Megillah of Purim doesn't have any revelations in it. It's the one book that we have of all 24 books of the canon, what they call in English a Bible, that doesn't have God's name once, which means a completely hidden book. So how is it that something that's written in order to conceal actually reveals? But if a person could grasp that trick, then you could know how to take your own life and reveal the areas that seem to be only darkness. Very, very seriously and literally. Let's try and understand this together. Now, you know that on Monday nights we try to look as deeply as possible into an issue. Right? If you are not the kind of person who has a mind for delving, then I'm not offended if you leave. On Sunday nights we usually have a more relaxed look at things. But on Monday nights we don't make any apology for the fact that we try to look as deeply as we can. So let's try and do that. And the deeper we go here, you'll see the most fascinating insights. Can you maybe move a bit forward so I don't have to shout? Those who come here at the door, can you? Okay. Maybe you could all move forward just a drop. Here at the back. That's the ideal way to hear this shoot. But we're really hidden. Okay, now, if what we're saying is correct, what we aim to do, let's try and set out where we hope to get to, and then as we look in depth, we hope we'll be able to achieve those objectives. What we're saying is that the real nature of the world is its hiddenness. Now, that is the way the world is set up, is that it's hidden. You don't see any spiritual revelation in the world. On the contrary, when you try and look for it, you don't see it. And the more you look at your own life and those of people around you, you'll see there's not a happy place. It's not intrinsically a happy place. I mean, especially this, what's going on right now, a person doesn't need to be prodded in order to see that. But the brutality and the superficiality and the inhumanness of what we're living through is a tremendous darkness. So Purim should be the idea where we could see how actually that darkness reveals light. But that's not easy. Now, if that's correct, it should explain to us many things. First of all, we should have insight from this discussion into the creation of the world, what it means Adam and Eve, Adam and Chava, what they did, what their sin was, the whole, and that's the beginning of creation, that's the beginning of human experience. So the dilemma that they found themselves in, the mistake they made, but that should also be explained by this subject, because we're going to the root of creation. The worst parts of your own life should begin to become clear, the purpose in them, or at least the fact that there is a purpose should at least begin to become clear from this discussion. We're working on a Megillah that doesn't have any revelation, and out of that we hope to bring out revelation. That's the secret and the source of the happiness of Purim. The reason that we laugh on Purim is that because we're able to bring out a tremendous joy from what looks like sadness. It's another reason we wear masks on Purim. The reason we wear a mask is because what we're showing is that what reveals itself on the outside one way is actually another thing on the inside. There's a great mystical work based on mystical principles of Ben Yisachar. He says that we actually not only can perceive the hidden depth on Purim, we can actually make it come out into the open. And actually we have to make it come out. And if we don't, it remains hidden. And if it remains hidden, it really is hidden, and it never was there. That means only if we learn to bring it out do we make it real. He says we see it. In the mystical language, it's called Isarusa Delatata. It means the awakening that happens from beneath. It's a whole deep subject, but there's another awakening that happens from above. When Hashem reveals himself from above in a way where he does certain things that we see miracles. Purim, he doesn't do anything that we see miracles. We become the miracle. Right? Our lives become the miracle. So he says that if you want to see it, you look, where do you look for this on Purim? Obviously in the most superficial dimension. You look in the mask dimension. Where do you look? You look at the simple, superficial customs that we have on Purim. Chanukah, we know, is a time when Hashem revealed himself. The light burned miraculously. Our Jewish survival was connected to a light that burned miraculously for days. Purim, there was no miracle that happened. No lights burned. There was no open miracle at all. Just what we were supposed to be killed on that day, we survived. But there was no open miracle. So he says that if you look, you should see this even in the most superficial Jewish custom. You know, we have an understanding that even the most superficial thing that we do is pregnant and potent with meaning. When we wear a mask on Purim, it's a very, very deep idea. It's not just having fun. So he says, on Purim you see that what we do is, when we want to drown out the name of evil, that means when we want to bring the revelation of goodness into the world, we do it by trying to drown out the name of evil. And we do it by spinning what they call a draga, the thing that you... What's it? No. Not a draga. It's a... Rashan, yeah, dragon. You spin, are you with me? The thing that makes a noise when you, on Hanukkah you spin a dragon. So Ben Yisachar says that they're not superficial customs. The Purim, the Hanukkah idea, is that the hand spins from above. Yisarusa de la'ela, a hand comes down and makes the world turn from above. On Purim it's a hand from below turning the spiritual world. It's a remarkable thing. What you think is just an accidental custom that's been with the Jewish nation for centuries must have a root much, much deeper. But the whole trick of Purim is to see the depth in what seems to be very, very superficial clues. And to realize that those are what the depth really is. Let's try and examine it together and see where it takes us. We also would like to understand from this discussion a deeper insight into what's happening in the Middle East right now and our place in it. We did have a discussion on this about a month ago, and you referred to the recording of that discussion if you want to bring this out into its depth of application, the way I feel it should be in this situation. But I think we should say enough now that also should make it clear. So there's an idea that's discussed by Reb Tzadok, one of the great mystical thinkers of the last century, who expresses the idea something like this. Now, you've been warned, we're going to go into depth here. We're going to cover the range of Jewish history, of the world's history, of Torah from the creation of the world till the end of time. He explains as follows. Again, while we're discussing the subject, what we want to understand, we want to open gates in the neshama. And we're not listening to an interesting discussion that makes connections that we didn't see before. That's missing the point. If that happens, it's nice, and you heard it via Torah, and it's a schus for Klal Yisrael, and it's nice. But that's not good enough, right? What we want to hear here is opening pathways that were closed in you before. You want to see yourself as a Megillah, your life, your family's life as a Megillah that never was opened. And you've been able to roll it from one end to the other to be able to see it, that it lights up. Try and understand. The Gemara says like this in Megillah. The Gemara says, Haman min ha-Torah minayin. A remarkable thing. The Gemara says, where's Haman's name found in the Torah? Haman. Do you all know the story of Purim? Is anybody here who... You know the story of Purim. The Jews were... haven't got time, unfortunately, to go through the whole story. The Jews were threatened by a man called Haman, tried to wipe out every Jew all on one day, and at a remarkable turnaround of events, the Nahapok word, one instant everything was inverted, and they were destroyed and we were saved. Are you all familiar with that, more or less? If you want to prepare yourself for Purim, I would suggest, the best suggestion I can make is that apart from this discussion, I would suggest that you get a copy of the Megillah of Purim of Ma'am Lo'ais. Ma'am Lo'ais was a great Ladino Sephardi giant who wrote at least 27 volumes covering the Torah, bringing out the hidden depth together with the halachic perspective, a remarkable experience. And today it's been all translated into English. And the Megillah of Esther is one of the most fascinating and brilliant pieces of writing you'll ever come across. It is such a thrilling novel. He makes it into such a thrilling book that you can't put it down. He describes all the Midrashim between the lines of the Megillah. When the Megillah says one sentence and then another, he traces the development, what this must have led to that, by bringing in the Midrashim that explain it. When Esther called Ahasuerus a dog, she had to marry him, right? She was subjected to the indignity of having to marry this non-Jewish king. So she called him a dog. And she was criticized for that. But you know why she called him a dog? Because he was brought up by dogs in the forest. He was brought up by wild dogs in the forest. He wasn't brought up by humans. But there's a great depth in what she said. And explains it. What was his life in the forest as a child? And he goes into the Midrashim that explain the background and the intricacies and the intimacy of these people in their lives. It's a very, very fascinating. If you want to have a Megillah come alive, I would suggest that it's a very, very fascinating place to start. In English. Now, the Gemara Megillah says this. Haman min HaTorah minayin. Where do we see Haman's name in the Torah? Now, that question needs some explanation. We have an axiom like this, that everything's mentioned in Torah. Your name is mentioned in the Torah. We've tried to discuss this on previous occasions. Rabbi Ordman was here not so long ago. He showed how the codes in the Torah reveal the names of political events, people, dates, right? All the details of history revealed very clearly in the most fascinating mathematical computerized fashion. But there's another depth we said before, that every Jew's name is mentioned in Torah. There's a verse in the Chumash, in Tanakh, that begins with the letter that your name begins with and ends with the letter that your name ends with. And that describes your personality. It's a remarkable experience. People who look up that verse for the first time are almost, I've never yet seen a case of a person who wasn't struck by the depth with which that particular pasuk describes their nature, their personality. You look it up in a siddur, trace your name and see where it's located in Torah. That's just one aspect of it. But we have a concept that the name of a thing is mentioned in Torah. What does it mean? It means that the depth of the essence of that concept, of course, is mentioned in Torah, because Torah is the blueprint and the essential dimension of anything. If a person exists, it means that before he came into being, there must have been genes that coded for all the details of what he is. The Torah is the genes of the world. So, of course, the genes must be there. You can't have a hand unless there were coding in the genes that built that hand. And therefore, anything that exists in the world, the genes of that thing must be in Torah, and the genes of a thing are its name. A name is the essence of a thing. Right? Sometimes it's a deeper essence even than the body of the thing. If you have me, if you have my body, you have less depth in me than if you have my name. Although the name that you have is only abstract, but the name is a very deep essence. When you say that name, I respond. And if you say the name correctly, you could get me to do almost anything. If you hold on to my body, you can even beat it and torture it, but you can't force me, you can't draw me close. But if you have the name, you can. Which is why it says that the whole Torah is just the names of Hashem. But it means again that a name. That's why the word Shem in Hebrew, which means a name, also means Sham, it means there. Because there is the final stage of a thing, it's Tachlis. While you're going towards it, you haven't reached it. But when you get there, you've reached the end point. Which is Vashamayim, which means the spiritual world, is also called Shammim, there, theirs. All the theirs that you can never say there about is the spiritual world, because no place to go after that, you've arrived. That's the same word as Shem. It means when you finally get to Shammim, you see in English we've been bludgeoned and perverted into thinking that you get to heaven. But you don't get to heaven, where you get is there. You get to a place that's the final place, there's no place to go after that. That is the there and that is the name. You get to your name in the end. The name that you were given when you were born, which is a mystical secret that you were given that name. Your parents think they chose it, but it was put into their minds from the spiritual world. Because it is your essence. That name, I don't mean Clyde or Brent or Brett or... No. I mean your real name, your Hebrew name. That's the essence of what you are. So now we have the following understanding. When a name is mentioned in Torah... I don't mean to offend anybody's name's Clyde. Yeah? There's nothing wrong with an English name. as long as there's a Hebrew name behind it. Now, the thing is this. When you have the name of a thing, you have its location of essence. So the beginner says the following thing. Where do we find the name of Haman, the great evil genius, right? Whose like we didn't see, right? Not in every generation in history did we see such an evil genius. There were some outstanding generations that saw people so single-mindedly devoted to killing Jews at any cost, even suicidally. We saw it 50 years ago. And you might even say that even more recently in Jewish history, we have seen personalities that are bent on wiping out Jews no matter what it costs them, and no matter when they're being invaded and about to be wiped out, the most lethal threat that they and their whole people, the whole nation could ever face, they've got the time to be sending missiles to a country where it's completely uninvolved. That's what's on their mind. Let's understand that. That's a symptom and a sign of the Amalek mind. Haman was a man of Amalek, which we'll try and explain tonight. The Amalek mentality is to kill Jews, and the worse he gets squeezed, the more he tries to do it. Understand that. Not that the more pressure on him, the more preoccupied him, so he worries about his own survival. He doesn't care about his own survival. The more he's pressurized, the more he'll try to take out whatever Jew he can. No matter how futile, he'll try and do that. Understand that very deeply. Now, that's what I said, that you'll understand how relevant this is all to what we're experiencing now. We just have to govern that this Purim will be the same turnaround. The fun of Purim is only when the turnaround occurs. It wasn't funny for the Jews who earmarked for destruction. It was only funny for them when things turned around. But while you haven't yet experienced the turnaround, it's not funny at all. You understand it. So the Torah wants to know, where is the name, the Gemara wants to know, where is the name of Haman found in the Torah? What it means is this. You have to understand deeply, we just can't speak out all the depth of it all the time. But we mean this. If you understand it superficially, it means, mystically, the name of everyone's written in the Torah. Where's Haman's name located in Torah? But the depth of the question is this. Haman represents something. He is a spiritual force. That spiritual force must have its root in the root of all spiritual forces, which is the Torah. Which means if you could locate his name in Torah, you would be able to grasp his essence. You'd have his genes. You'd be able to understand exactly what he is and what must flow out of what his personality is and all his descendants and all those like him in the world. So where would we expect to find Haman's name? That's what the Gemara wants to know. Because if I locate where his name is, I'll have an inkling, a clue, about how deep the concept of what he is goes in creation. That's the question. So the Gemara answers the following answer. Haman's name is written clearly in the Torah in the following place. There's a sentence in Bereishis, in Genesis, that says like this. Hamin ha'etz, from the tree, you remember after Adam ate the fruit, the forbidden fruit of the tree. So then Hashem appeared in the garden. This all doesn't mean it physically the way we understand, but nevertheless, for now. Hashem appeared in the garden, and he said to Adam, or the man-woman combination, he said to them, did you eat from the tree which I commanded you not to eat from? That sentence begins with the word hamin, which in Hebrew means, ha is an interrogative word, which means did. Is it so? Did you do? Min means from. Did you eat from? Are you with me? Did you eat from the tree? The word that's used to ask the question when God asks man, when Hashem asks Adam, did you eat from the tree? The question is posed with the word hamin ha'et. Now the word hamin in Torah spells Haman. Without the vowels, the way the Torah is written, that word is Haman. Now that needs some thinking. What's going on? Did you eat from the tree? What's that got to do with Haman? We're supposed to find here the depth of his personality. We're supposed to find here the core of what Haman is. What's that got to do with the question that God asks man, did you eat from the tree? And it must be very powerful and potent because it's back at the beginning of creation. That's the beginning of sin. The name Haman is the first word. It's the word that Hashem uses when he speaks to man after man has fallen, after the sin. That's what Haman is in the world. But it's Hashem speaking. But it's Hashem speaking to a man who's already fallen and can't hear him speak clearly anymore. He's trying to understand in depth. Hamin ha'etz, did you eat from the tree? The Gemara goes on to ask where all the names of Purim are found. Esther, min ha'Torah, minayin. Where is the name Esther found in the Torah? Esther, the great Jewish woman who saved the Jewish people at that time. And Mordechai, min ha'Torah, minayin. Where is the name of the great Jewish sage who was the brains, the mastermind behind the salvation of the Jews in that generation? Where's his name found? The Gemara gives wonderful, amazing answers. Mordechai is from Mordor, which is a very mysterious ingredient of the incense, a very wonderful smelling incense, Esther, the Gemara says, is from the verse that the Torah says, on that day, Hastir Astir Esponai, on that day I will hide my face. The word Esther means to hide. Right? If it's not already clear that we're dealing with a saga, a story of hiddenness. Right? It's called Megillas Esther, which means incredible thing. Megillas Esther means the scroll of Esther. But as we explained before, the word Megillah means Megale, to reveal, and Esther means to hide. You hear that? If you have any sensitivity, you hear that Megillas Esther means the scroll of Esther. But in any sensitive dimension at all, it means the revealing of the hidden. Megillas, the Megillah that reveals, Esther, what is hidden. Right? Because a Jewish woman is what's hidden. The hidden dimension is what a Jewish woman is. That's what Esther was. Completely hidden. No one knew she was Jewish. No one knew who she was. She ended up mysteriously. She wouldn't reveal where she came from. A complete secret of hiddenness. Where's her name in Torah? When Hashem says that when you disobey me, when you leave me for other gods, when you forget about your Jewishness, on that day, Hastir, Astir, Esponai, on that day I will certainly hide my face from you. The threat that Hashem makes that he will hide his face, that word is Astir, which is Esther. That means that Hashem telling us that he will hide from us, but it doesn't mean he disappears, it just means he hides. Which means he pretends not to be there. That's what hiding is, right? Hiding doesn't mean you disappear, it means you stay, but you wear a mask so the person can't see you. That's what hiding means. You stay right close to the person. You don't have to hide if you're far away, is that clear? If you run, if you move away from the person, you don't have to hide. The only time you hide from someone is where you're clear, but where you're near, but you don't want him to see you. That's what Esther means. That's what Hastir means. I will pretend not to be there. The Gemara says that the students of one of the great Tanaim asked, the Talmidim said, why did Hashem make a decree of destruction against the Jewish people in that day? So he said, you tell me. That's a fantastic understanding of the teacher's technique. The Gemara is teaching you how to be a teacher. The Talmidim asked the Rebbe, why did such and such happen? So he said, what do you think? To make the student think. And you want to work out the rest of the shit by yourself. So he said, why do you think? So they said, well, it was because the Jews went to a meal that they shouldn't have. You know, the king made a feast. Actually, the feast was a celebration of the fact that the temple hadn't been rebuilt. 70 years had passed, and the promise was that within 70 years, the Beis HaMikdash would be rebuilt. So he threw an international party, the biggest imaginable. He ruled the whole known world, all 127 countries. He threw an international feast for 6 months, for months, for days, weeks, months. A feast celebrating the fact that his rule was established because the Jewish temple hadn't been rebuilt. And the Jews were invited to that party, and they went. They went because they felt it was life and death. You don't disobey a king's order. What's wrong with going to the party? The food was kosher. It says that he had the traditional food of every people laid on. The wine was kosher. No one was forced to eat or drink. Everything was perfectly with the best hatcher. It was mahadrin mina mahadrin. It was whatever you eat, it was arranged. They had the best mashkishin. The king arranged that everybody would have his food. And so the Jews said, what's the problem? All right, on the table they were using golden vessels from the Beis HaMikdash. The wine goblets, the cups, the things that were used there, he was rubbing it in with the Jewish people and using the vessels that today are in the Vatican, by the way. Many of those are in the Vatican. I actually know someone who's seen them. But many of those vessels are in the Vatican today. Doesn't matter. Anyway, he was using these kalim that he had in his possession from the destroyed, from the Beis HaMikdash. So the Jews knew that was an indignity, but they felt to disobey Pikuach Nefesh, to save their lives, they should go. Mordechai, the leading Torah sage, told them, you must not go. It looks the opposite to what it is. The normal, the common wisdom is you should go. But the Torah depth is, let's not go. If you go, you'll bring a destruction of death upon us. And they couldn't see it, and they disobeyed him, and they went. That's what the student said. So Rabban Yochanan said to them, if I'm not mistaken, he said to them, that's not the reason. And you haven't thought well enough. Because that would only explain why the Jews in Shushan, the capital, had a decree against them, because they went. But what about the Jews in all the other 127 countries? They didn't go to the party. So why was there a decree of destruction against them? So the students couldn't answer. So he said, because they bowed down, wherever they were, they bowed down to an image of a god other than Hashem. Actually, it wasn't really bowing down. It was an image that is worn around the neck of a man who was an emissary of the king. It was permitted to bow. But nevertheless, it was an avarice that they shouldn't have done. Actually, I'll just spend 2 seconds as an aside. That actually tells you, by the way, for those who know anything of the halachas of Purim, the fascinating insight into why Purim is celebrated for one day But in Shushan, it's celebrated on another day as well. Because the Jews there had two Aveiras. You understand that? The Jews outside had one Aveira. They bowed down to the image. But the Jews in Shushan bowed down and went to the party. So that's why we commemorated that there are 2 days there in the cities and only one outside. Anyway, be that as it may. When he answered that to the students, he said to them that the Jews bowed down. So the Talmidim said to the Rebbe, but that was only a pretense. That was their objection. The Jews only pretended. They weren't worshipping another god, Chas v'Shalom. They were on a very high level in that generation. They would have given their lives easily for Hashem. They were only bowing down as a pretense to stave off a death sentence. So why did Hashem make a decree of death against us? So he said Hashem was also only pretending. That's what the Gemara says. That means this was only what's called leponim, that means to the face, on the outside. Hashem also did only Elul upon him. He was only doing, that means, it wasn't yet sealed in blood. It was signed the decree, but wasn't yet sealed in blood. Which means that in the spiritual world, the decree against them was signed and sealed, but not sealed in blood. Which means that Hashem wasn't really going to carry it out. It was just a threat to make us do tshuva. Why? Because we had pretended, it's an amazing thing, we had pretended to divorce ourselves from Hashem, which is what we're actually doing right now, if you think about it. When squeezed badly enough, we'll come back. But right now, outwardly, we show ourselves to be not observing Torah the way we should. So you see that the whole story, again and again, is a story of hiddenness. Of hidden presence, which is actually there, but doesn't reveal itself. That's exactly what it is. That's why the Gemara says that the name Esther comes from a place in the Torah, which means I will hide on that day. When you walk away from me, I will pretend to walk away from you. I'll be with you, but I'll be hidden and you won't see me. Now, with that understanding, that background, let's go back to Haman and see what it means that his name is located in the beginning of Bereishis in Genesis. To understand it, we'll have to take a trip, a voyage through Jewish history. We'll have to see some events that happened to us as a people. We'll have to see what happened to Adam, what he did in the garden, what his sin was. We'll have to see a number of events that happened in Jewish history together. Okay? Yes, you with me? Getting too hot for you? Try to stay with me. We'll try and make it short. See if we can take this voyage together and see what we can discover. The root of the concept of Haman. Haman was born from a nation called Amalek. That's what we have to understand. This Shabbos, we had the mitzvah of Zohar. This Shabbos, the Shabbos that precedes Purim, you have to hear, you listen to the Kriyas HaTorah, and in Shul we read the recalling of the fact that Amalek is our intense enemy in the world, and that our job is to wipe him out. We have to destroy completely the concept of what Amalek is, and then the divine spiritual revelation will take place. After Amalek is out of the world, we can move forward into Purim. That's where we are now. Between the eradication of the concept of Amalek, that nation called Amalek, and the concept of Purim. Amalek actually also means the death of the concept of pretense. Amalek means the nation in the world that tries to look kosher, understand, tries to look moral. They always declare that what they're doing is holy. If it's a war, then it's a holy war. If it's torture and brutality, it's in the name, it's in Hashem's name. You have to understand that. By the way, it isn't only we discussed last week, I believe, the B'nai Yishmael and the B'nai Esav. It isn't, unfortunately, only the Arab bloc. It's also the West in general. Both of those blocs try to show themselves kosher on the outside, but are brutal inside. The Arabic world is a world that shows tremendous inhuman brutality towards the Jewish people, and in general, while trying to show itself as holy. And the rest of the Western bloc has shown tremendous, unbelievable brutality to the Jewish people under the name of Christianity. Now, 10 million Jews were killed by the Catholic Church alone, tortured to death by them. You understand that? That's what we're up against. Now, but they show themselves on the outside, not just as acceptable and kosher, but as holy. They try to reflect on the outside spirituality. But on the inside, they aren't. In Chazal, it says that there's a creation in the world that represents that force, and that's the monkey. Because the monkey is very close to human on the outside, but is only an animal inside. That's what it is. That's why the word monkey means, the word actually means to copy the human form. Ape in English. Even in English, ape. means to copy the human form. In Hebrew, the word koif, kof, koif, right, means that which pretends. And the word Amalek, if you think about it carefully, it spells Amal Koif, the work of the monkey. That's what Amalek means. That's what that nation is. It's the nation that does the work of mocking the human form, trying to look human on the outside as only murderous brutality inside. That's Amalek. Now, let's understand what this nation is, and the whole scene will, Yitzhak Hashem, become clear to us. Amalek is as follows. What we're saying tonight is complicated and deep, but this is the core of it. Okay? If a person could grasp this idea, everything else will become clear, and with time it will be developed and become clear. This is the idea to grasp. There are two forces in the world, the Jewish people and Amalek. But those are the two poles of reality. In the mystical writings it says that they're the two males of the world. The rest of the world is female that wants to get married, wants to accept one of those forms. But the two male forms in the world are us and Amalek. A male wants to impose his form on the female. That means he wants to have a relationship with her so that a child will be born in his image. Those are the two male nations, and they're intensely in conflict with each other. Right? We and Amalek. You know, it says when they attacked us in the desert, we see this for the first time, that when the Jewish people left Egypt, Amalek attacked us. Right? They were direct descendants of Esau. Esau tried to destroy Yaakov. Esau's grandson, Eliphaz, chased Yaakov and tried to kill him, and he managed to only escape barely with his life. His son was called Amalek, again tried to kill the Jewish people. Again and again and again, they'll do anything to kill us. And that's their job. That's what they're here for. Halavai, we should do our job of being spiritual and bringing Hashem into the world, as well as they've done their job through history of trying to wipe us out. They do their job very well. That's what Hashem puts them in the world for, is to threaten us like that. Understand that? Amalek was the nation that tried to wipe us out at every opportunity. No matter how suicidal it was, they tried to wipe us out. You know, when they attacked us in the desert, what weapons did they use? When they came to try and kill us in the desert, you know what the mystics described that battle as? Do you know what the battle was? They did many terrible things. They tried to kill us. Any Jew who was weak enough that he couldn't stay within the clouds. You know, we were surrounded by mystical clouds of protection. Any Jew who fell out of the cloud, they killed. They butchered brutally. They couldn't get inside the cloud. But any Jew who was weak spiritually and fell back out of the clouds, they killed immediately. But you know what the real battle was? You know what they came to do to the Jewish people? It's an unbelievable thing. In the mystical sources it says, homosexual rape. That's what they did. That's what they were into. Why? Not just because they were perverted. It means trying to impose the male form on the male. You have to understand that. They want the world to take on their form. That means we should become female. Do you understand? We should become female with respect to them and take on their form, and it's their values which should operate in the world. And we want that the world should take on our spiritual values. Our values are being mevatel ourselves to Hashem, that we're nothing. Hashem's presence is what counts. We are just the testimony to Hashem's essence in the world. They are the force that shows that Hashem's not here. We what count. Exactly the opposite pole. You know, 50 years ago, the leader of the Amalek nation, right? 50 years ago. You know that the Gemara says that Amalek would eventually become called a country called Germania Shel Edom. You know that? Germania. That's what it says. Well, in that country 50 years ago, there was a leader of Amalek, exactly with Amalek characteristics. And he said that the Jews have foisted two evils on the world. I'm quoting you from his famous work. Circumcision on the body and conscience on the soul. That's exactly right. Circumcision on the body, we make a covenant with a higher reality. And conscience on the neshama means that we act in accordance with a higher reality. And that's what he came to stamp out. That's exactly what Amalek is. They stamp out circumcision. They stamp out any bris, any connection with the higher world. Their bris is what they want on the world. Their maleness. And they stamp out conscience. We are the conscience of the world. We what count. What we say goes. Might is right. That's our philosophy. You say might is not right. What's right is right. You relate to Hashem. We say Hashem isn't here. He's distant, if he exists at all. That's the Amalek philosophy. Now, let's understand. When the Jews were going through the desert, Amalek attacked them. Rashis Goyim Amalek. They were the first nation that attacked the Jewish people. They were suicidal in their attack on the Jewish people. There's no way they could win. The Jewish people had just experienced 10 plagues in Egypt, the Red Sea splitting. They had been miraculously shown to the whole world to be Hashem's chosen people. There was no greater moment in history than that. The moment was so intense that in Midrash it says that all peoples on earth saw Hashem's revelation, and they started streaming towards Sinai. You know that? They went to the greatest man alive of the time, who was Bilam, a great non-Jewish prophet, and they said, what is this cataclysmic event that the world is shaking so? And he said to them, don't worry, it's not a flood. They thought it was a flood, they thought it was a fire. He said, it's Hashem oiz la'amo yitain. Hashem's giving Torah to his people. So all the nations of the earth said, if that's true, let's go and accept it. If Hashem's giving Torah to his people and it's free for anyone, let's go and accept Torah. And the nations of the world started flooding towards Sinai, says the Midrash. When Amalek saw that if all nations on earth would come to Sinai and they'd receive the Torah with us, what would be their job? Their purpose is to keep Hashem out of the world. They put you to make it difficult. They put you to keep a blanket, a wall between us and Hashem. That's their job. They represent the gap between the world and Hashem. So the only thing they could do was throw themselves suicidally into an attack on the Jewish people. They knew they wouldn't win. They knew that it was impossible to make any impression on a people that was divine. But what they did was, they showed that we were human. And the nations turned back. They got badly burnt. They got almost entirely wiped out. Very few of them were left. But they achieved their objective. You follow? The objective wasn't to beat us. They knew they couldn't at that stage. But they had to save the world in their terms. Right? From going over to the spiritual version. They had to keep the world human. That the human ego is what counts in the world. That's their job. So they threw themselves with incredible force at the Jewish people. They were almost wiped out. And they licked their wounds for the rest of history until they managed in various generations to gather enough strength to attack us again. But they did the job. The world rejected Hashem. It says, Asher korcho v'derech, that when we were going on the road out of Egypt, they met us on the road. The word korcho v'derech is an amazing word in Hebrew. The root means three things. It means they met us on the road, but it means to meet by accident. Mikre. Mikre in Hebrew means an accidental meeting, because they never would admit that anything was planned. You follow? The whole idea in the world is to say that things happen. Not because there's a direction, but things happen. So they met us accidentally. Keri means sexual impurity, because that's exactly what they stand for. I can't go into detail, but it means it's the kind of impurity that happens to a man. It's a putting out of male energy where it's not received by a woman to give fruit in the world. We can't go into detail, but it's a terrible, terrible force of negativity. That's exactly what they represent. Not everything has to be brought to fruition. Not everything's got a purpose. On the contrary, things don't have a purpose. They blast out your energy into the world until you're finished, until you die. That's the way they see the world. And thirdly, let me think about it. And thirdly, it means cold, kar, mikre, kar. They cooled you down on the road. They cooled you down. You were so burning hot. The Jewish people were so flamingly alive and excited and devoted to Hashem that they inflamed the rest of the world. So they threw themselves at us and cooled us down. Rashi says, it's like a man who throws himself into a bath of boiling water. He gets very badly burnt, but he cools the water down. That's what happened. They threw themselves at us, they got terribly burnt, but they cooled us. Enough that we couldn't bring the final revelation to the world, the final redemption, and that the rest of the nations turned back immediately. That's their job. That's their job. Now. Our mitzvah is to kill Amalek. Not to kill them, not to wipe them out. Right? It's a terribly hard mitzvah. Do you know that the mitzvah is that if you would meet an Amaleki, you would have to kill him, you'd have to kill him with your hands. That sounds an awful thing for a religion like ours. But you have to understand, it means meeting a Hitler. That's what it means. It means meeting a person like that. There are certain characters roaming the underground spaces of the world at this present moment. It's not so hard to imagine doing the necessary. That's what Amalek is. That's what they represent. That's the mitzvah. But what we have to understand is this, that the mitzvah of the war between Amalek and us physically is only a physical image of the spiritual battle. Everything in the world has a physical form, but it represents a spiritual reality, as we discussed here many times before. Amalek is a nation of human beings that wants to kill us human beings. But spiritually, they are a force that wants to kill our force. Our force is to bring Hashem into the world. Their force is to keep Hashem out of the world. That's exactly what they are. Whenever we're about to bring Hashem into the world to make a revelation, to show the world that Hashem is with us, they'll do anything to stop that. And at the end of history, they'll throw themselves in for the last suicidal attack and they'll die finally. Right? And this generation, just before the coming of the Mashiach, they'll throw themselves in with every last thing they have because they've nothing to lose now. Their final act will be an act of complete suicide, but they'll take as many of us with them as they can. Right? And they'll give anything and everything in order to stop us being Jews. That's what they'll do. They'll try and destroy our bodies totally. Wipe us out. Now, let's understand. Haman was a descendant of Amalek. He was a child of Amalek. His only job in the world, his only task, was to wipe out Jews. Of course it was. That's what Amalek is. Haman rose to power only to wipe out Jews. Now let's understand. What does it have to do with the words in Bereishis? Haman, did you eat from the tree? Let's understand. It's one of the most beautiful ideas that you'll ever hear in Torah. What happened when man sinned? What happened when Adam sinned? Adam ate the fruit of the tree. What was the result of the sin? The result is that Hashem moved away from him. Before that, he spoke to Hashem directly. He witnessed and experienced Hashem's presence immediately at all times. Hashem spoke to him face to face and directly. He was in the spiritual world entirely. After he ate the fruit, he dived, crashed into the physical, and Hashem moved away equally into the spiritual world. And now he doesn't see, one doesn't see the other. Man doesn't see God anymore. That's where Adam found himself after the sin. How do we see that in the Torah? Hashem arrives in the garden and he says to Adam, "Where are you, Ayeka? Where are you?" That's the way he addresses him. Ayeka, where are you, is the same word in Hebrew as Eicha, Lamentations. The book of Lamentations is based on the word Ayeka, where are you? So Hashem comes into the garden and he says to Adam, "Where are you?" When Adam says, "Here I am," Hashem says to him, "Did you eat from the tree Hamina ate? Did you eat from the tree that I told you not to eat?" You know what you hear in those words? You hear the following thing. Stop for a moment and think. What is Hashem asking man where he is? God doesn't see you? Adam is hiding under a tree in the garden. Hashem doesn't see him? Of course he sees him. Isn't that strange? Hashem has to come into the garden and say to Adam, "Did you eat the fruit? Where are you?" Adam says, "Here." "Oh," and then he can see him. And then he says, "Did you eat from the fruit?" Hashem didn't know that he ate. Of course he knows. It's one of the 13 principles of our faith, that Hashem knows everything that happens. So of course he knew where he was, and of course he knew he ate from the tree. Why did he ask him? For the following amazing reason. When man moves away from Hashem, Hashem moves away from man, and he lets him think that he doesn't see him. He hides his face, and man looks around, he doesn't see Hashem anymore. So that if he wants to, he can think that he isn't seen. And of course, that's why you have free will to operate. Because if you knew Hashem was watching you, you couldn't put a foot wrong. But because you think you aren't seen right now, because you suffer, you have the illusion that Hashem doesn't see you right now. It's a very powerful illusion. It's more real than not. You think Hashem doesn't see you. So you're free to do what's wrong. How does Hashem allow you to think that? He pretends he doesn't see you. So he can't speak to Adam. If he comes into the garden and he says, "Adam, look, you ate from the fruit," so then he's telling him that I'm with you and I see you. He doesn't do that. He plays the game. You hear? He comes and he says, "Where are you? I can't see you." And Adam has to say, "Here I am." And he actually is led into the relationship in which he's allowed to believe that Hashem doesn't see him. Do you hear the subtlety, the beauty of that idea? And then he says, "Did you sin? Did you eat?" In other words, I don't know. I have to ask you. I function with you as if I don't see you. Because Hashem only relates to us the way we relate to Him. You hear what those words are saying? So the word Haman, which is the word which means the distancing of us from Hashem, that Hashem's out of the world and we don't see Him, that word is in the question, "Did you eat?" Because it's asking the question that allows the gap. Are you with me? The wonderful idea. If there's no question to be asked, only a statement, it means you're here with me now. If you have to ask the question, it means I'll let you think I'm not with you. That question, which is fantastic, because the word Haman, the word in Hebrew is ha-min. The word doesn't mean anything in Hebrew. Ha-min is only prepositions, pronouns, whatever you call it. Did from. All it is a question. You follow? It doesn't mean anything. Ha-min. Are you with me? Ha means is it so, and min means from. But that's exactly the point, because what the point here is the question. It's just the very fact that Hashem asked the question that leads Adam to think that Hashem doesn't see him. That's what it means when Hashem, that's what it means that Haman. So you see that the concept of Amalek, the concept of Haman, what happened on Purim, starts in the Garden of Eden when man sins. When Adam Rishon sins and he moves away from Hashem, he brings into the world Amalek. He brings into the world that nation called Amalek. He gives birth to it. From his own action, when he steps back from Hashem, he puts into the world a gap, a chasm between him and Hashem. That gap is called Amalek. The name of that distance is called Amalek. Now with that we can understand some fascinating ideas. So we have here the following thing. The root of the idea is by Gan Eden with Adam Rishon.
The next time we come across that people, Amalek, is when the Jewish people are leaving Egypt. There's a tremendous threat that the world will come to its final perfection, tremendous promise and hope that in that generation the world will finally spin up to its spiritual root. Amalek can't stand that. They throw themselves at us. When does it happen again? Be long before Purim. I'll just choose one example and share this with you, and we'll leave it at that. There was a generation when again the world, there were many times this happened, and each time the story is the same. But let's try and choose an example. But the idea always is that Amalek will throw themselves at us, and the way we'll beat them is with spiritual activity, by being Jewish. Not by beating them down physically, although we might have to fight. But it's by doing what we're supposed to do. I'll give you a most fascinating example. What happened? Who remembers? Who knows enough Chumash? If you come to this shirim for as long as some of you have been, should at least a Mietzah Hashem, it's my fervent tefillah, inspired enough to at least start studying some of it yourself. So where do you see what happened during the battle with Amalek? When the Jews were battling, Yahushua was the general, and he was leading the Jews in a battle against Amalek.
So we have here the following thing. The root of the idea is by Gan Eden with Adam Arishan. The next time we come across that people, Amalek, is when the Jewish people are leaving Egypt. There's a tremendous threat that the world will come to its final perfection, tremendous promise and hope that in that generation the world will finally spin up to its spiritual root. Amalek can't stand it. They throw themselves at us. When does it happen again? Long before Purim. I'll just choose one example and share this with you, and we'll leave it at that. There was a generation when again the world, there were many times this happened, and each time the story is the same. But let's try and choose an example. But the idea always is that Amalek will throw themselves at us, and the way we'll beat them is with spiritual activity, by being Jewish. Not by beating them down physically, although we might have to fight. But it's by doing what we're supposed to do. I'll give you a most fascinating example. What happened? Who remembers? Who knows enough Chumash? If you come to this shirim for as long as some of you have been, should at least the Mietzah Hashem, it's my fervent tefillah, inspired enough to at least start studying some of it yourself. So where do you see what happened during the battle with Amalek? When the Jews were battling, Yahushua was the general, and he was leading the Jews in the battle against Amalek. And down in the plain, the Jews were fighting a lethal battle with Amalek. What was happening at the same time? Moshe Rabbeinu was standing on the mountain, do you remember? Holding his hands up. When he held his hands up, and they were heavy, when he held his hands up, we won the battle. When his hands dropped, they won the battle. What's the meaning of that? You know what it says in the mystical writings? It says this. When he held his hands above his head, we won. When his hands dropped below his head, they won. You know what that means? The hands are the organs of Asiya. The organs that do in the world. That go out and act and do. The head is the organ that thinks and understands in the world. The Jewish people are naseh v'nishma, like we said last week. We are people that does before we think. We do before we understand. We are for Hashem because that's our loyalty. Not because it's right or wrong, or because we know what it means. We don't know what it means. Naseh v'nishma. You follow me? A person should be loyal to his wife because loyalty is what a person should be, should have. Because she's his wife. Not because you keep reassessing whether she's worth it all the time. That's not what it means. Friendship doesn't go that way. Love doesn't go that way. Love, loyalty, friendship means that you give yourself, and once you've given yourself, it's total, inalienable, and never able to be taken back. That's how we love Hashem. Once we committed ourselves, once we got married in the beginning of history, so then we now say, from now on we'll do it anyway, like we explained in great depth last week as best we could. We offer Hashem and we do. Afterwards, we hope, we dove and we'll be able to understand. When he held his hands, the Naseh dimension, higher than the Nishma dimension, you follow that? When the action, when the Jewish people are out doing for Hashem, whether or not they understand, then we win the battle, we bring Hashem into the world. When we drop the hands below the head, and the head dimension becomes what counts, if I understand, I'll do, if I don't understand, I won't. I'm the final judge. So then Amalek wins. Of course they won, that is Amalek. Amalek is me and my ego and what I understand. And the Jewish people is me and my hands, I do for Hashem before I understand. It's a wonderful, wonderful idea. That was the battle with Amalek. Now, that's why it says by Matan Torah, it says, Atem Eidai, you are my witnesses. Hashem says, you are my witnesses in the world. If you want to know the function of a Jew, it's to be Hashem's witness. Do you know what a witness is? A witness testifies that something is. Is that right? But a witness testifies that something is when you can't see that something. You don't need a witness when you can see that thing. No courtroom brings in a witness when the event happens in front of them, because they are the witnesses. The only time you ever need a witness is when the thing can't be seen and you need to know that it happened, then you get a witness. That's what we are. Hashem can't be seen in the world. Don't fool yourself, he can't be seen. If you look for him, you'll only see the opposite. Where do you see Hashem in the Jewish people? We are the witnesses that testify with our blood and our torture that we've been through and everything in our survival, our death and our survival. We are the evidence. We are the only evidence. What else is there besides us in the Torah? What else is there in the world? Outside there is only brutality. Nothing out there testifying. The closer you get to what looks like Hashem out there, the bigger disappointment it will be, because it shows you more and more deeply that it's only showing itself kosher on the outside. But inside it's butchery. So you, me and you, we the witnesses of Hashem in the world. We, where He isn't and He can't be seen, we the witnesses. We testify that He is. With our blood, with our life. That's what we are. Amalek is the gap that Hashem can't be seen. That's what Amalek is, the fact that He can't be seen. The ball's in their court. The game's going their way. Eretz Nitna B'Yad Roshet says, they've got all the cards in their hands. Everything's on their side. You just have to look at the world and you see it their way. There's no question. The only thing that makes it look the way it really is a Jew's lifeblood that's been given for this. That's what we are. That's what a witness is. That's what we are. Now, let's just choose one more example to understand. It says that there was one more time when the Messianic revelation could have occurred. Moshe Rabbeinu could have been the Mashiach. They could have gone into Eretz Yisrael. They could have finalized it then. They failed. There was another time in Jewish history, at the year well, when this was possible. When was that? Now, you know that when the Mashiach comes, he will be Mashiach ben David, a Mashiach from the house of David. But he will be preempted, he will be introduced to us by what's called Mashiach ben Yosef. There are great mystical, wonderful things about him. According to some mystical opinions, he may not survive. He may have to die. We hope he won't. But the Mashiach ben Yosef will be a Mashiach from the house of Joseph, born from Rachel Imenu. Mashiach ben David is born from Yehuda, from Leah, from that line. But the other great Jewish women, there were two who married Yaakov. Mashiach ben Yosef comes from Rachel. First comes Mashiach ben Yosef, and then he gives over to Mashiach ben David. You begin to hear over here, you should begin to hear Purim. Because who was Mordechai? Benyamini ben Kish Ish Yemini, from the house of Benyamin. Mordechai, who brought in the revelation, the final redemption of the Jewish people, that last stage of redemption that we had, when we accepted the Torah, it says, we really accepted it in the darkness, when the Megillah was a revelation, was Mordechai from the house of Benyamin. There was a time before that, when a great man from the house of Benjamin was able to bring in the Messianic era. Who was that? King Saul. Saul. Shaul was from the house of Benjamin, from the tribe of Benjamin, and he was supposed to conquer the world in Torah and give it over to David. He was supposed to make a partnership and give over the kingship to David, the Mashiach ben David, and the world would have reached its perfection. But Saul failed. What happened? This is what happened. I'm sure by now you can work it all out for yourself. We've said enough details now that I'm sure you can put the whole scene together. But I'll do it for you. Let's do it together. And let's see if it obeys all the rules. If Saul was able to bring the Messianic revelation and bring David to power and bring the final Mashiach ben David, so what has to happen before he can do that? He has to kill Amalek. He has to kill Amalek. Because when you kill Amalek, there's no force left in the world that keeps Hashem out of the world. Mimela, automatically Hashem's in the world. You follow? As soon as every Amaleki, as soon as every human spark that is a gap between us and Hashem is out of the world, so there's no gap anymore. And then Hashem's here. But as long as there's one of them left on earth, but Hashem can't be here because there's a gap still. So his mitzvah was to wipe out Amalek. Literally and physically, he had to go to battle and wipe them all out, right down to the animals. Nothing of Amalek had to be left alive in the world. So what happened? Saul led the Jewish people in a battle against Amalek. And he almost made it. But he left only a few sheep, a few animals, the best of them, and one man he left alive, the king, Agag. Why? I don't understand. First of all, I'm not going to... The mystics say that the sheep actually were humans, transmuted into sheep. Amalek, they were great sorcerers, great masters of evil wisdom. And in order to save their lives, they transmuted themselves into sheep. I understand that, it's another story. But anyway, they took them in order to sacrifice them. He didn't intend to leave them alive, but he wanted to offer them to Hashem. Not just wipe them out. He wanted to wipe them out as an offering to Hashem. That's what he wanted. But one man he left alive, Agag. What happened? His mitzvah from Hashem was clearly to kill them and kill every last one of them. Saul left Agag alive. Why and what happened? This is what happened. The next morning, Shmuel, that night, the prophet, Samuel, Shmuel, got a prophecy from Hashem. Saul has failed, and he deserves to have the kingdom torn away from him, and he's destroyed the cosmic future of the world. Instead of perfecting the world by wiping out Amalek so that David could come, and we could have the Messianic age, he's left Amalek in the world. And Shmuel cried to Hashem all night, but it didn't help. The next morning, Shmuel went to meet Shaul, and he said to him, "What have you done? What have you done? You've left. What have you done?" So they brought out Agag, and Shmuel killed him. He chopped him in pieces with a sword. He called for a sword, and Shmuel himself, the great prophet of the Jewish people, killed Agag on the spot. He cut him up with a sword. That says, we read it in the Haftarah last week on Shabbos. But, says the Gemara, he remains in the world one night longer. Instead of dying in the battle on the previous day, he survived until the next morning when Shmuel killed him. And that night he had a sexual relationship with a woman in the camp, and she was pregnant, and when he died, his seed was left in the world. Who was born from that woman? That woman had a child, who had a child, who was who? Haman. Agag, the king of Amalek, seed was left in the world. And of course who came out of that seed was a king of Amalek again, was Haman, whose job again was to kill the Jewish people at Purim time. And that's what happened, and the story hasn't ended yet. Why? Why did Saul do it? Why did Shaul not observe the mitzvah of Hashem? Hashem told him openly to do it. Why did he disobey? Listen well. There was a man before Saul who had a command from Hashem and disobeyed. Adam. And he made the same mistake. Saul copied the mistake of Adam HaRishon, and for the same reason. Same mistake. Why did Adam eat from the fruit? Right? That's the thing most people don't know. Why did he eat from the tree? There's a very, very wonderful dimension of understanding. One dimension of understanding of why he did it, which is as follows. Why did he disobey Hashem? He spoke to Hashem personally and closely and immediately. He knew exactly what the world consisted of. He had no pull to evil. The world was clear to him. Everything was revealed. It was a messianic perfection. A few more hours, Shabbos would have happened, and the world would have been lifted to its permanent state of perfection. Why did he spoil it all? He couldn't resist the taste of the fruit, whatever that means. He had to do that. He did it for the following reason. And this is where we all make our mistake. Obviously. Since we're only just sparks of his neshama, this is where we all go wrong. Adam said the following thing. Hashem, you've put me in this garden of perfection. I see you clearly. I have everything I need. I do no work. I enjoy only your presence. It's the most perfect world. But Hashem, you've forgotten one thing. You haven't given me the opportunity to do anything for you. The only thing you've let me do for you is not just not eat this fruit. But Hashem, that's so easy. That's so easy. It's such a small thing. I love you so desperately that I want to give my life for you. I want to do the hardest things imaginable for you to show you how much I love you. Love is only how much you give. You've given me so much, Hashem. You've given me my existence and this whole world. I want to show you how much I love you. And all you've given me is one tiny mitzvah. One tiny thing, just not to eat this fruit for a few more hours. But that's not enough for me. You follow? I have such a burning love for you that I want to do anything and everything for you, no matter how difficult. So you know what I'm going to do, Hashem? I'm going to disobey you. I'm going to eat that fruit. And I'm going to mess the world up. And I'm going to crash into the world. And I'm going to find myself far away from you. And then I'll fight back up here through my own energy, and that'll show you how much I love you. I don't want it as a gift. I want to do it my... You hear the Nagia inside. Back deep inside was that old same human voice. Me. I want to do it my way, not your way. I want to be the one who does it. Very true motivation. It's all for you. It's all for you, Hashem. I only want to do it out of love for you. But the deep inner Nagia, the deep inner motivation is I want to be the boss. I was very true. But it had that. And therefore, Hashem, when you told me that if I eat the fruit, I'll die, it means I'll risk death. I know that. I'm prepared to go through death for you. Even that I'm prepared to do for you. And I'm going to drop myself into the mess, and I'm going to climb up by my own bootlaces, and that'll show you. And that will be an expression of the love for you. Do you hear what his motivation was? An incredible, incredible level of ruchnias, or spirituality. I once had a Rebbe who said that Adam Rishon was like a man in a rocket. He was going 1,000,000 miles an hour. And all he could do was work the controls to go 1,001,000 miles an hour. And that wasn't enough. You follow? He said he'd rather go 10 miles an hour and build up whatever he gets out of his own effort, because then he did it for Hashem. So he decided to make that move when he ate the fruit and he realized what it meant. And he realized how bad it was too late. When he realized that it could never be the way he thought. And the thing to do with Hashem is listen and obey and not figure out. He knows all the calculations. All he wants is obedience. That's just what he wants, is for you to accept the depth of what he is and not figure it out for yourself. But he made that mistake. What did he do? He brought into the world deliberately the gap between him and Hashem so that he could close the gap through his own effort. That's what he did. Saul, when he battled Amalek and he witnessed Agag in front of him, you know what Saul said to himself? Says Rav Tzadok. You know what Saul said? Saul said to himself the following thing. As he was about to kill Agag, he wiped out the whole of Amalek. As he was about to kill Agag, he said to himself, 1 second. If I kill this man, what happens? The total immediate messianic revelation. And what work will there be for us? What will happen to the glory of the Jewish people who are Hashem's witnesses, who give our lifeblood for Hashem to bring him into the world? Where will that be? It will all be a gift and it will all be passive from then on. So I'll leave one tiny spark of Amalek in the world. That's all I want. I'm not going to make the same mistake as Adam Rishon. I'm just going to leave one man, that's all. Just enough so there's some work for us to do. Just a little gap in the world, Hashem, that's all. Just so that we as a Jewish people can close that gap and show you. And what happened? Purim. Haman. Who tried to wipe out all the Jewish people. When Saul realized what he'd done, it was too late. And Shmuel told him that everything was ripped away from him and he failed and he was despised by Hashem. The same pathway again and again and again throughout history. That's what happened. The perfect marshal for this concept of what we said last week. Na'aseh v'nishma. First we do, we don't make calculations. Of course you make a calculation before you start out to know that this is the way to go. You don't throw yourself in foolishly to something you don't know anything about. You first have to learn enough about Torah to reassure yourself that that's the right way to live. Of course it has to be sincere. Of course there's a nishma that comes before the nasi. We are not superstitious people who just blindly accept anything, because then you might as well accept anything. You have to know that it's Torah before you throw yourself into it. But when you know that much, then you give yourself entirely. That's what being human means. When you marry someone, when you give your love to someone, right? You choose wisely. No one says you throw yourself at the first thing in a skirt that passes in the street. You choose very carefully, much more carefully than we do. We should choose very carefully. It's the rest of your life that's involved. But once you've chosen, you give unconditionally. After you've chosen and you've decided to give, you give everything, your life, last drop of blood you have to give. Permanently, with no questions asked, ever. That's what love means. That's what loyalty is. That's what we do. After we bought that relationship, after we entered it, from that time on, there's only loyalty. Only Na'aseh and then Nishma. The perfect marshal, I think I've mentioned it to you before, I'll tell it to you again, the perfect illustration of this idea, I heard from a very great Rosh Hashiva, beautiful marshal, which is, as I think it's a marshal of the Dibna Magid. And the marshal is, what does it mean not to outsmart Hashem? What does it mean? Adam HaRishon outsmarted Hashem, right? Hashem told him, I want you to obey. He figured out why actually what Hashem really wanted is that I should eat and it'll be better that way. The message is not to do that. And the marshal is the most beautiful, beautiful marshal. The marshal is like this. At once there was a king. And the king had a very beloved servant, a courtier, one of his royal members of the... So once that man came to the king and he said to him that he wanted to go to a banquet with all the royal notables that evening. So the king said to him, my good friend, you can go to that banquet, but on one condition, lay no bets. No betting. That's all. Simple. That's my request. No wages. No betting. So the man said, sure, that's easy condition. He went off to the banquet, undertaking not to lay any wages. That's what happened. The next day, the man came back to the king after the banquet. So the king said to him, how was the party? So the man said, it was fine. King said, did you lay any bets? So he said, well, I have to admit I laid a bet. But when you hear what an easy win it was, you'll definitely agree with me. It was such an easy win that your condition obviously wouldn't have applied had you known what it was. What happened? This is what happened. I walked into the banquet. All the notables, the royal, they all gathered around me and they offered to take me on a wager for 50,000 rubles that I've got a hunchback. Now, Your Majesty, I haven't got a hunchback. There's no way I could lose that bet. So I rolled up my shirt and I collected 50,000 rubles. What's wrong with that? So the king said, you fool. They took me a bet for 100,000 rubles that they could make you roll up your shirt in public. Now, what this means for Purim is simply the following thing. It's late and I'm not going to keep you any late. But it means that this is what happens. The world is a dark place. It's a place where all we experience is the gap between us and Hashem. The function of a Jew is to close that gap. That's what we're supposed to do. And we do it through the Megillah, that's Megale. When we read the Megillah, we don't do it through any other book of the Torah. Every other book of the Torah doesn't count because it tells of Hashem clearly. The Megillah doesn't mention Hashem, and it's there where we see Hashem, that's where we close the gap. Do you know that it says that Haman, do you know, if a person works to bring the gap into the world, so then, like Adam did, like Shaul did, what's the result of the gap that we have to work to close the gap? That's good! Despite the fact that it's a mess and a mistake, but one little element of goodness did come out of it, that we're able to do the job now. So the Gemara says that Haman had a descendant who learned Torah in B'nai Brak. One of the great Tanoim of the Talmud was a descendant of Haman, converted to Judaism and brought Torah to the world. What does it mean? It means that of course if there's a gap in the world, you can close the gap. And what closes the gap? If there's a darkness in the world, you can bring the light. What is the light? Torah. Where the Jew puts Torah into the world. So you go into that chasm of darkness and you put the light into the world. You couldn't have done that had it not been for the sin. That's the upside. That's the positivity that comes out of this whole mess. Well, at least let's do that. But at least let's do that. It's true the place is dark. It's true it's only a gap and it's only brutality. But the whole purpose of that, the only benefit there is so we can close that gap in whatever small way we can. Which is us being the witnesses, bringing Torah, bringing it, which is Hashem, bringing that into the world. That's what you do at Purim. When you read the Megillah, you read a story that doesn't mention Hashem's name at all, and in that story you see Hashem. That's a revelation. To read the going out of Egypt, when the miracles occurred, obviously you see Hashem there. That's not closing any gap, that's Hashem closing the gap, that's the hand coming down from above. But Purim is our greatness. The real acceptance of the Torah happened at Purim time. When Hashem gave it at Sinai, we had no choice. Hashem came down and gave it. Who could refuse? But at Purim, when Hashem didn't reveal himself at all, and we saw, that's called acceptance of the Torah. That's where we kimu mashe kiblu kfar. We brought down the Torah into the world. At Purim time, when we didn't have to, when it was all dark, we did the work and we brought Hashem into the world. That's what Purim means. One great mashgiach in Eretz Yisrael said that the what you have to do with your life, let's just end on a personal note. You have to write a Megillah of your life. That's what you have to do. Because if you look at your life, all you see is things that don't make sense. All you see is suffering and things that, if you're honest and you look openly, you'll see unbelievable suffering that doesn't have any justification in your life. And if you're not sensitive, or if you're lucky, then in your own life, Baruch Hashem, up to now, Le'aleinu, you don't have any suffering. Just look one house away. I don't think there's a house in this town where a person can look one house away and not see tremendous suffering. Tremendous suffering, lifelong pain, somewhere in your family, or in your connections, or one of your neighbors, at least, if not many, many other places. What you have to do, you have to write a Megillah of your life. Do you know how Megillah works? When you read through the Megillah, it doesn't have any revelations. It doesn't mention Hashem's name, no miracles. The Jews went to a meal, and this happened, and Xerah, and Haman, and the queen, she got married, and Haman, one night he came, just the same time, she was there, the Mordechai did this, all the threads just happened to coincide at one point. All the themes of the Megillah just happened, that's all. Mikre, Amalek. It just happened to cross. All political, sociological events, no divine intervention, nothing. And as they crossed, destruction of the Jews became salvation for the Jews. But you only see it when you see the flow. You don't see it at any point. There was a plot to kill the king, so what? Esther married the king, so what? That's a tragedy. Haman arrived with a request for the king, so what? But when they're all read together, as they flow together, you see how they connect? Then you see Hashem. You have to write a Megillah of your life. When you look at any event in your life, it doesn't make any sense. But when you look at what's happened to you, and you write the story, you write the Megillah, and you see what crazy events, what seemingly insignificant details led you to what else, and what that led you to, and where that brought you, and when you finally have come, and you see all the threads interweave, nobody can be so insensitive that they don't see an amazing Hashgacha working. If you're insensitive in your own life, you just have to look what's happening now to us as Jewish people. The threads that are being woven together. The targets that are being picked. I don't want to go into detail, but Again, we've seen in the last few days, I just had a communication from my family in Israel. Told me about people that they are connected with, where destruction occurred in a way that, in the normal course of events, would have cost many, many lives. And people were exposed to destruction. They weren't in safe places. They were in sealed rooms in the house. They weren't in bomb shelters. The person has to see what's being the message. The message is a pretense. That's what it is. It's a threat of destruction, but it's not for real. As long as we stop pretending and go back to what we're supposed to be doing. Right? But it keeps happening that schools get hit on Shabbos. 3 schools on 1 Shabbos because no one's at school on Shabbos. And 4 floors of a building collapsed recently. A building was hit. All 4 floors collapsed. And no one in the building was injured. The man in the bottom floor, when they dug him out after removing the rubble of the whole building, brushed off his coat and said he wasn't going to hospital. He felt fine. My family know of a family where a child was crushed under a wall. A baby in an oxygen, in one of these mask things. The equipment was completely decimated and shattered and the child was gurgling happily when they got the rubble off the child. When it's happening time after time, an amazing, amazing hashgacha that we see. It's leponim only. That is, it's a threat that's constant. And the more pressure they put on him, the more the threat keeps coming. But the threat will remain a pretense as long as it gives us the chance to come back from what we're supposed to be. From what we're doing, that's a pretense. Who knows how much rope we'll be given. But that's what we have to do. We have to write the Megillah of us and of our history and how we put it.